Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, our topic today is nullification, how we as a country can be stronger. Today we are very happy to have as our special guest, Dr. Thomas Woods. Welcome, Tom.
I'm glad to be here, Michael. Thanks for having me.
No, I'm very honored to have you on our show. So, folks, Tom is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute and is a New York Times best-selling author. He is the author of many excellent and prize-winning books. And today we're going to discuss his newest and, in my opinion, a vitally important book, Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century, which, by the way, folks, this is currently, and it was just released a couple of weeks ago, and it already is the number one book on Amazon under constitutional law. So, Tom, there's a growing sense of discontent and even anger among Americans who witness the Congress and the president doing whatever they want with what appears to be a complete disregard for the Constitution. You start off your book, Nullification, with a story about how Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, responded when a reporter asked her where in the U.S. Constitution she found the authority to impose a health insurance mandate on all Americans. Please tell us about that incident.
Oh, sure. Yeah, this has become a celebrated incident. Yeah, she's asked, where do you get the constitutional authority to do this? And her response was, are you serious? Are you serious? And then she laughed and moved on to the next question. Now, that's typical.
And then you tell a similar story about a Senator Mark Warner.
Oh, Mark! Now this guy's the all-time doozy for all time. Mark Warner wants to address this question as well, and his response—I mean, it's dumb. Like there just aren't words in the English language sufficient to describe how dumb his answer is. He says that he, in effect, concedes. Okay, sure, the Constitution doesn't anywhere say the federal government can involve itself in health care. But he says at the same time, the Constitution doesn't anywhere say that you, an American, can buy a telephone. But we've just decided over the years that that's how we're going to live. So he thinks that that's a parallel situation. He thinks that the government not being able to, in effect, order us around with regard to health care is the same thing as us buying telephones. The difference is that the Constitution exists to restrain the government. So the government has to check the Constitution before it acts. The Constitution does not exist to restrain individuals. We don't have to check the Constitution. Hey, can I go to Taco Bell today? Let's see what Article 3 says. It has nothing to do with it at all. The Constitution, we presume to have liberties, whereas the federal government cannot presume to have powers.
That's right. So what these people are missing, and I love it how you've said this, the people are not restrained by the Constitution. It's the government that is restrained by the Constitution. I love that. I love the way you put that.
Well, unfortunately, of course, it's all been completely inverted, which is why we need to engage in our topic for today.
Mm-hmm. Well, this problem is quite serious also within the government, and it's quite pervasive. Tell us about what the Solicitor General said.
Oh, yeah, this one's a doozy. Back in the 1990s, one of the Supreme Court justices asked the Solicitor General, which is basically the government's lawyer in Supreme Court cases, asked the Solicitor General, can you name for us any area of American life over which, in your opinion, the federal government would have no authority under the Constitution whatsoever? And the poor guy just stood there dumbfounded. He had no answer at all. And I've been asked in interviews, if I were questioning Elena Kagan, what, if I had one question, what would I ask her? And I would basically ask her that. I'd make it easy. I think I'd make it a little more challenging on her. Why not? She's about to go on the Supreme Court, right? I would ask her, name me three areas of American life where the Constitution absolutely definitively rules out government involvement. Just three. It should be easy. I don't think she could name two, and she could barely name one.
Right. Exactly. Well, we're going to talk about this more when we get back, folks. So we're coming into a break. So please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and I have Professor Tom Woods with us. And we're talking about nullification, how it's going to make us stronger. So please be with us. We'll be back right after the break. And we're back, folks. So this is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me is Dr. Thomas Woods, and we're talking about nullification. And we were just talking about how it's quite apparent that the majority of people in government today, particularly on the federal level, are unaware of any boundaries that they are restricted by. Tom, this is an outright contempt for the Constitution. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, certainly it is. And, I mean, you know, it's true that governments are very hard to restrain, and pieces of paper tend not to work very well in restraining them. And this is precisely why there needs to be some kind of external restraint on the federal government, that some kind of enforcement mechanism. And that's, frankly, that's where the states come in. If the states do not function as a restraint on the federal government, then there will be no such restraint. It will continue to grow, and it will continue to defy any attempt at restraining it by voting for people or waiting for court cases. No, these things only wind up increasing its power. Only the states, and even then, only with great difficulty, have the chance to restrain it. But we have been taught to despise the idea of the states. The states are stupid and backward. They probably just want to oppress people. This sort of narrative of American history has worked very nicely for the federal government because it has served to demonize those forces that might have the best chance at keeping it bottled up.
Well, you know, I know that I and a great many other Americans were at first quite optimistic and then profoundly disappointed when in 1994 Congress seemed quite serious about shrinking the size of government. And then over the next, you know, decade, went drunk with the power to expand government the way they saw fit. It seems like the electoral option has failed, and this is, of course, where your book comes in, that Americans do have another option. And so tell us in general terms about this Jeffersonian concept of nullification.
Well, the idea comes about basically when Jefferson is contemplating the question, what is to be done when the federal government transgresses its constitutional boundaries. And, you know, as you know, this is obviously not a hypothetical question. This is very, very important. It has indeed happened and was happening in Jefferson's day.
Well, Jefferson, in fact, it didn't take very long.
10 years.
The country, yeah, and then
yeah,
the
exactly.
Sedition Acts, which most Americans are unaware of. Could you kind of just...
Yeah, that's right.
That?
One of the pieces of legislation Jefferson was concerned about. So in other words, this was not entirely just Jefferson in a leisurely way contemplating political philosophy. He was forced to contemplate this because of the Sedition Act that made it a crime to be excessively critical of the president or the Congress. You could be fined or imprisoned, and indeed people were. And, you know, Jefferson's view was, you know, I'm pretty sure you can't do that. And so he wanted to know what recourse was there in a situation like this. And what's interesting for us today, I think, is what Jefferson ruled out, what he ruled out as being effective ways of resisting. So, for example, we would be inclined to think today that, well, we should refer this to the federal courts and see what the Supreme Court says. Oh, okay, well, in Jefferson's day, the Supreme Court was dominated by the so-called Federalists, who would have indeed held up this law. So a lot of good that would have done. But more importantly, Jefferson's view is that the Supreme Court is part of the problem. The problem is the federal government. The Supreme Court is a branch of the federal government. It can't be an impartial arbiter between itself and the states. So that's not going to work. And what would be more likely to happen would be that the federal courts would just rubber stamp everything, which indeed is precisely what they've done. You could elect people. You could wait a couple years. And indeed, Jefferson himself was elected in 1800. But Jefferson was not saying, let's wait till 1800 to resolve this. He was saying, we got to resolve it now. A lot of liberties can be lost between now and then. And plus, who's to say, maybe in 1800 you vote for another bozo, or maybe you vote for a guy who gives good speeches, but he gets in power and does the opposite. What would be the way to resist? And so Jefferson's argument was, and as I've indicated before, if the states don't function as restraints, nothing will. So the states have to say, look, you know this is unconstitutional, and I know it's unconstitutional, so therefore, out of respect for the Constitution, we can't allow this thing to be enforced in our state, and so we're just not going to do it, period. We're not going to do it.
Well, you know, I really enjoyed reading your book, and I recommend this book very highly, folks. This should be a 101 book for every high school student in every civics class, because most Americans are not brought up understanding this 1798 Kentucky Resolve that, Tom, you were just alluding to, and also Madison's Virginia Resolve resolutions that he wrote. But more to the point, what was particularly interesting to me is that, as you quote here, all speeches rang with these resolutions in mind. This idea of nullification was quite profound. It actually was turned on Jefferson himself in his second term as president, when in 1807 he declared this New England embargo prohibiting American ships from trading with England and France. Would you tell us a little bit more about that particular incident of that economic warfare against what essentially was against Americans?
Yeah, this is very significant, I think, because it goes to show how we need to understand the opposition to Virginia and Kentucky. Virginia and Kentucky in 1798 were the states that stood up and said, we're not going along with these Alien and Sedition Acts, and we believe in nullification. And Virginia and Kentucky passed, respectively, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of that year, the first of those drafted by Madison, the second by Jefferson. And at the time, a lot of the New England states said, oh, this is a crazy idea. You've got to just sit back and take the Sedition Act. And in fact, the New England states were all in favor of the Sedition Act. They said it's a wonderful addition to our country. There was a terrible infestation of untruths, and now we're going to strike them down and smash them. So the New England states were all against nullification because they were in favor of the Sedition Act. That's why they were against it. So then, 10 years later, barely 10 years later, the New England states all of a sudden start talking nullification. Isn't that funny? This is the thing the historians leave out. The historians dwell lovingly on the criticisms that New Englanders made of nullification in 1798, and then they totally neglect the fact that 10 years later, New Englanders are talking the same thing. And so I put some of the documents just to prove this in the second part of the book. It's all documents, and I've got the Connecticut legislature and governor talking about this, saying, look, not only do we think the embargo itself is unconstitutional, but the way it's being enforced is certainly unconstitutional. I mean, there's no question these are unconstitutional searches and seizures. They're just on the merest suspicion that we might be thinking of exporting something. No matter where in a country the cargo is, you can just take it, seize it. I mean, this is just ridiculous. And so the New England states said, you know, we're not going to assist in the enforcement of this. State officials are not going to assist in the enforcement of it. You'll be punished and removed if you do. So, in other words, the northern states had recourse to these very ideas using the same language that we hear from Jefferson and Madison 10 years earlier. So this is not some kind of secret plot to restore the Southern Confederacy today. I mean, this is an idea that spans the whole country, north and south alike. In fact, more often we hear it from the north than from the south.
Well, let's summarize on that first point, that nullification basically means that it's up to the states to declare a law null and void and refuse to enforce it. And, you know, this brings up, as you touched on earlier, our current arrangement, where the federal government is really set up to determine whether its own laws are legal and valid. You call this monopoly power on its own constitutional interpretation. And I wanted to read from the bottom of page 5 in your book. You write, so in a dispute between the states and the federal government, the resolution is to come from the federal government? So please expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the basic bottom line here is that, and I guess what we need to consider, and I mean, we have a break coming up, but we need to consider is that the objection to this, which would be, well, wouldn't this be chaotic, though, right? We'd have certain states doing some things, certain states doing others. And one of the people I include in the documents, Abel Upshur, a great Virginia judge, he entertained all these objections and I think answered them more effectively than I've ever seen them answered. He says, look, there is no perfect solution, but the two potential dangers are as follows. One, you have a totally unlimited federal government, or two, you have the inconvenience of some states enforcing some laws and some others. He says, well, okay, I know which one I am more afraid of, and you know, and I think it's what we're living through. It's an unlimited federal government. But secondly, we should just remember That is what the United States was supposed to be, a group of states which some did some things, some did others. That was the whole point of the U.S., and now we think of this as something to be avoided. No, that's to be embraced. That's what the U.S. is supposed to be.
Right. It is actually that. It is, as you say, the United States are, they are not an is. And I think that's that was a quote. I took that from Art Carden's little piece that he just had published in Forbes.
Yeah, and, that was very generous.
Yeah, it was very good. Well, you know, there was one other thing you touched on a couple of minutes ago about the Supreme Court, because I know I was brought up with the idea that the Supreme Court was really the final arbiter of determining whether or not laws were constitutional or not. And but you have this great quote in here that the Supreme Court may be perfectly impartial, a perfectly impartial tribunal to decide between two states, but it cannot be considered in that point of view when the contest lies between the United States and one of its members, meaning states.
Exactly. And this is why in his famous report of 1800, James Madison said, we need to have some defense mechanism for those cases in which even the judicial branch betrays the Constitution. They are not infallible, and we need to be protected against them as well.
Yeah, and this lack of infallibility is actually an important principle. I mean, we all regard Thomas Jefferson as being a great bulwark of our establishing and vocalizing our rights, but even as we saw in 1807, he himself was subject to that overreach of power. So we're going to have to take another break, folks, and so please stay with us, and we're going to come back in just a couple of minutes. And when we do, we're going to talk with Dr. Thomas Woods more about this topic of nullification. So please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Thomas Woods. And, Tom, what did Thomas Jefferson and James Madison warn about this? You know, that government was going to continue to grow and regardless of the other things that we thought might actually inhibit its growth.
Well, they were concerned primarily that if the federal government, as you said before, monopolizes the interpretation of the Constitution and monopolizes the determination of what the scope of its powers are, it's going to keep discovering new powers. I mean, and this would be the case, human nature being what it is, if any person were in a contract with another person, but only he could interpret the terms, well, he would tend to interpret the terms in his own favor, even if he had to stretch the meaning of the clear meaning of the text in order to do so. So that's the main concern. You cannot allow this sort of monopoly. The states need to have their interpretation of the Constitution count for something. The states are the creators of the federal government. The Frankenstein monster does not tell Dr. Frankenstein how to run his laboratory. I mean, he is the creator.
So we can actually expect, without nullification, for the federal government to continue to grow regardless of elections and regardless of this separation of powers of that central authority, which we call the federal government.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And yet it's, you know, if this is the sort of thing that when you hear it, when you hear the argument, you hear the logic of it, it just makes sense. You know, I mean, I remember one of the earliest interviews I was doing on this was with a radio host who, you know, has been around kind of a while, and I presented this to him, and I thought he's going to think, well, this is just some kind of crazy, you know, I haven't read this in Newsweek or seen it on MSNBC, so am I even allowed to think it? And I presented it to him, and he said, well, makes sense to me. And I think it does, actually. It just makes sense. You hear the logic of it, it makes sense. But yet, so far, now, the book has not been out that long, but so far, most of it, with the honorable exception of Judge Napolitano, who's always an honorable exception, he's the Ron Paul of the media. He's the one guy you have to say, well, I hate the media, but there's Judge Napolitano. Other than that, the big radio and TV people won't touch this with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much sense it makes, they won't. And yet, the book is selling robustly, even without the major media that you normally need to get a book to sell robustly. So
yeah,
we're cracking through just on the strength of the argument that
right.
Madison and Jefferson made so long ago.
Well, it makes so much sense because, you know, as you say, the central authority cannot put checks on itself. And the real separation of power are the states and the citizens. And that is the basic flaw in the concept of the three branches of government, that they're all basically of the federal government, and that they're all basically connected.
Exactly. You know, actually, Jefferson said, well, what's to stop the three branches from just ganging up on the people? Well, that's exactly what's happened. I mean, he knew that would happen. He didn't go for all these civics textbook platitudes about how the separation of powers would preserve liberty. Why should they? There's no particular reason. It's the amount of power they have, and that we can only limit, really, by forcing them to stay limited through state nullification.
I want to read another quote from your book, and here it is, folks. Much more important than the feeble restraint of checks and balances is the ability of the states to interpose to prevent the enforcement of unconstitutional laws. This is the real check on federal power. Tom, would you comment on this word interpose?
Yeah, interpose is the word that Madison preferred to nullification. He used the word interpose. So interpose, the image of that is the state standing in between the federal government and an unconstitutional law on the one hand and the people of the state on the other. Now,
so
interpose
basically means to intervene.
Right, exactly, to stand in between as a protector. Now, some people use these words interchangeably, interposition and nullification. I think probably interposition is a broader term because interposition would include, for example, the lawsuits that states are filing against Obamacare. Because that's not nullification. Nullification is, I don't care what your courts say, we're just not doing it. But interposition, it's a form of interposition. It's the states trying to protect their citizens, and the mode of doing it that they've adopted is to go to the courts. So interposition is broader. Nullification is more precise, and I think probably is really in the long run the only really effective means of interposition.
So, you know, you just touched on my next question, which are there other options to nullification, like petitions or the courts?
Well, this is what I've included in the documents section of the book, a totally forgotten but extremely persuasive and excellently written pamphlet from a judge named Abel Upshur. And this thing has not been reprinted anywhere since 1835, and you'll be blown away at how persuasive it is. He goes through and lists all the possible modes of resistance, every single one. Everything from signing a petition to violent revolution. He considers every single one, and he shows how nullification is superior to them all because it's effective, because it's peaceful, because of all, and he goes through every single one, and you find yourself just swept up in the current of his argument. So indeed, there are alternatives, but they're either too feeble or perhaps in some cases too extreme, and none of them really gets to the bottom, the root of the problem, the way nullification does.
Well, you know, one of the problems with the court option is that courts are always overturning other courts' decisions. So there's no relief that the matter may be settled.
Exactly. It could just go on and on and on. And in fact, or conversely, the Supreme Court, let's say, could just refuse to hear the case at all. And then, so then what do? You just stuck? So the court situation is likely to frustrate you.
Right, right, exactly. Okay. Well, folks, we're going to be coming up into another break, and I'm going to start talking with Tom more about these how we got here, the misinterpretation, the misapplication of three things, the General Welfare Clause, the Commerce Clause, and the Necessary and Proper Clause. So please stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market, and I'm having the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Thomas Woods. And our topic today, of course, is nullification, how it can make us stronger. So please stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Thank you very much for listening. And we're back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and we're here with Dr. Thomas Woods. And, Tom, we were talking just before the break about how we got here. And you list these three different major misinterpretations and misapplications in the Constitution, the General Welfare Clause, Commerce Clause, and Necessary and Proper Clause. Let's approach this in an ABC manner and first tell our listeners about this General Welfare Clause and what it was supposed to mean.
The General Welfare Clause, I'll sort of give away the punchline, has today been used, usually used by people, just sort of man on the street way, in the following way, that the federal government can do whatever it thinks will redound to the benefit of the people. That's what they think the General Welfare Clause means, and so if there's anything that they want done, then they say, well, it's for the general welfare, so of course the federal government can do it. Okay, well, what did it really mean? Well, Madison himself said repeatedly, and I mean repeatedly and throughout his career, and given how inconsistent Madison could be, this, it's very significant how consistent he was on the General Welfare Clause. His argument was, look at the structure of the Constitution. In Article 1, Section 8, we list the powers of the federal government. Now, if the federal government really had the power to do anything that would be for the benefit of the people, whatever's for the benefit of the people, we would not then say, okay, now here are 17 specific things. We wouldn't do that. He said, it makes no sense. General welfare simply meant that when the federal government is carrying out its delegated powers, it must carry out those powers with an eye to the general welfare of the whole country, not for the enriching of one part at the expense of another. So in other words, the General Welfare Clause does not grant the federal government an additional broad, unspecified reservoir of powers. It doesn't grant the federal government any additional powers whatsoever. It simply says, when you are exercising the powers we did grant you, you should always do it thinking about the general welfare of the country as a whole.
How did the Commerce Clause get morphed?
Oh, yeah. Now, the Commerce Clause, this is their favorite one. This is their all-time favorite. The Constitution grants the Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. Now, initially, this seems to have been understood, or Madison understood it, as primarily a negative power, to prevent the states from obstructing the free flow of commerce. So commerce is to be made regular so that it flows freely as a stream throughout the country without artificial barriers being put up in its place. So in practice and with the passage of time, this clause began to mean that, well, if anything affects interstate commerce, then the federal government can regulate that. So it is a positive power to regulate.
But it got pretty ridiculous.
And then it became ridiculous because, of course, anything, if you stretch it absurdly enough, can be said to regulate interstate commerce. So the federal government has basically thought, well, if we can regulate interstate commerce, we can regulate everything if we somehow define everything as being interstate commerce. So
let's ask you to just outline in very brief this one 1942 case.
Yeah. I had that in mind in particular.
Yeah.
This is the Wickard versus Filburn case. Now, here's a farmer. And he is contesting the argument that the federal government can regulate the amount of acreage he can bring in under cultivation on the grounds that he says, look, I'm growing wheat to consume myself and my family and my livestock. We're going to consume this wheat. And so the wheat hasn't traveled anywhere. It's in no way part of interstate commerce. I'm growing it here. I'm consuming it here. That's the end. So how can you possibly regulate that? That's obviously not interstate commerce. And the federal government said, oh, no. We beg to differ. It is interstate commerce. And here's how. What if you didn't grow that wheat? Then maybe you might have purchased your wheat from another state.
Oh my God.
So by growing it, you are abstaining from engaging in interstate commerce and thereby indirectly affecting it. So, I mean, this is absurd, right? This obviously is absurd. So it just goes to show they will define it absurdly so that they can justify regulating everything. And then the finally, after decades and decades and decades of letting the federal government get away with this, the great protector of our liberties, the Supreme Court, that will strike everything down if it's unconstitutional, decades and decades and decades of this nonsense, finally we get one case in 1995, the so-called Lopez case, U.S. versus Lopez, that finally the court puts its foot down. That involved the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990, which said, you know, you can't bring a gun within X number of feet of a school. Now, there were already 40 states with a law like this on the books, so it hardly seemed necessary anyway, but the argument there was, well, where does the federal government get the authority to interfere with a matter like this? This clearly seems like a state matter. Like, where does it get this power? And the federal government's argument, I mean, this is just, you can't believe this. You think, surely I'm making this up. Federal government's argument was, no, this affects interstate commerce, because if there's the possibility that there might be a gun in a school zone, then the students are going to be nervous about that. And if they're nervous, well, how are they going to learn? And if they don't learn as much, they're going to be ignorant. And if they're ignorant, how can they produce? They won't be able to produce as much. And if they don't produce as much, then interstate commerce will be reduced. And therefore, this affects interstate commerce. And the court said, you know, we've basically been pretty reasonable over the years. We've been pretty indulgent with you people, but this is just stupid. I mean, and it took that many years for them finally to say, all right, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah, nearly 60 years, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the necessary and proper clause, which I like to call the elastic clause.
Yeah. This is what our social studies teachers tell us, that you know, if you weren't convinced by the other two clauses I mentioned, then this is my ace in the hole, necessary and proper. This covers it all. Necessary and proper clause says the federal government has the power to exercise those powers that are necessary and proper to carry into execution the delegated power. So in other words, to make this simpler, simply means that, or this is the original intention anyway, simply means that if the federal government has the power to build needful buildings, which indeed is one of its powers, then by implication it would have the power to purchase lumber to build the buildings. I mean, it just means that whatever powers you need to carry out the ones we've given you, then naturally you would have those as well. So it doesn't
mean an act of Congress to just go buy lumber.
Exactly. Exactly. This would be understood to be subsumed under the powers of Article 1, Section 8. So it's a very commonsensical notion. It does not mean the federal government, again, is granted an unspecified additional array of powers. No. Any powers exercised under the Necessary and Proper Clause have to be tied clearly to a delegated power. Well, this clause is now being stretched to imply that federal government can pretty much do anything it thinks might be convenient. And, of course, it thinks everything is convenient. But no, it says necessary and proper. Well, what's very revealing is that Alexander Hamilton probably was the guy who most favored a strong central government, broad construction of the Constitution. And even he said, the Constitution would be exactly the same if we obliterated the Necessary and Proper Clause. If we took it right out, it would not affect the Constitution at all. It's just there as a note of clarification. So even he says this, that it's just there to clarify. It doesn't give them any additional powers. And the Constitution would be exactly the same if it had never been included.
Why is the Constitution not a living and breathing Constitution, as some people like to name it?
Well, where do I even begin? I mean, part of the reason is that when you look at what really matters is the ratifiers, the people in the states, when they were deciding whether or not to adopt the Constitution. James Madison said, if you want to know what the Constitution means, you go there. What did people believe they were getting themselves into? What is in those debates? And in state after state after state, supporters of the Constitution said, this Constitution grants the federal government only those powers that are expressly, and they used the word expressly, delegated to it. So they did not go on to say, but, you know, if 3 weeks later they decide that, hey, you know, it might be fun to have additional powers, it also has those. No, they said to the contrary, it has only the powers expressly delegated to it, and it can have additional ones only by amendment. So that's the opposite of a living, breathing Constitution. Secondly, I would remind people that the American Revolution was fought against a British government that had a living, breathing Constitution. That's what the British Constitution was.
Yeah, it was called King George.
Yeah, exactly. That's the Constitution. I mean, it was custom, it was tradition, but it was very slippery. It was very hard to pin down. You couldn't say, "Hey, you're violating Article 7," because there was no Article 7. And so it's precisely because the British Constitution seemed to evolve so easily, so readily, so as to take away colonial liberties, the colonists said, well, the heck with this thing. And so they made sure to have a written constitution precisely for this reason, precisely to pin it down.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I would say to people, if they believe in a living, breathing constitution, well, what if I came up to you and said, you know, I know you've enjoyed having free speech, but hey, you know, that is so 1791. You know, this is a living, breathing constitution. Now we can throw you in jail for speaking out. I mean, would you even have a leg to stand on?
Yeah, and I'd like to make this point related to your earlier comment about King George, that, you know, we fought so that the law would be king rather than the king's whims would be the law.
And indeed, that's why I've said that, you know, if you want to spit in the faces of the people who fought for American independence, then by all means, advocate a living, breathing constitution. Advocate the very thing they were fighting to get out from under.
Right, exactly. So, you know, after 200 years, we've seen this ratchet effect of this growth of central government. And, you know, this concept of ratchet effect, which our friend Robert Higgs has done so much scholarship on, I'd love to have you make a comment on that as well.
Yeah, the term ratchet effect refers to the fact that the government tends to grow, but it tends to grow in spurts, like when there are emergencies, whether it's a military emergency or a financial crisis or some sort of crisis like that, government expands for the supposed purpose of meeting the crisis. I mean, usually it winds up exacerbating the crisis, but that's at least the pretense, is that we're expanding for the purpose of the crisis. And then when the crisis recedes, the government will tend to be reduced. I mean, obviously, the U.S. government was much smaller in 1946 than it had been in 1943 with the ending of World War II, but it doesn't go back typically to the size it was before the crisis. It's smaller than it was during the crisis, but it always, so for example, World War I, we see income tax rates going way, way, way up, and after World War I, they come down, but they do not come down to the level they had been before the war. This seems to be a pattern throughout American history.
Right. So what is happening today? You know, let's talk about that. You mentioned several things in your book. You mentioned about the Real ID Act, the attempts of the states to allow medical marijuana use, gun use, and so on and so forth. And one in particular I found interesting, an effort to bring the National Guard home. In no particular order, please, if you would, touch on these.
Oh, sure. Yeah, gladly. First, the Real ID Act was one of these ideas, was one of these piece of legislation that united people who often are not united. So there were political liberals, civil libertarians, and fiscal conservatives who were all alarmed at this Real ID Act that involved, it seemed to be the first step down the road of a national ID card. And so you had a couple dozen states basically saying, we're just not doing this. And the federal government was stung and shocked by this. And basically, now they're still trying to pass it in one form or another, but they're still being stymied with it. They just decided, well, you know, we have enough fish to fry. We're just going to have to give up on this. I mean, we had no idea that the resistance would be quite so substantial. So that sort of inspired, I think, some of us to realize that, well, wait a minute. I didn't see this coming at all. Maybe there could be a revival of the idea of state resistance to unconstitutional federal law. So that was a very important moment, because I think it revealed to us that there was potential for this. The Bring the Guard Home movement bears a strong family resemblance to nullification, because it involves the reassertion of authority over the state National Guard on the part of the governors, just as the governors had authority over their militias. There are only three constitutional reasons for the federal government to call up or federalize the National Guard, and that's an actual invasion of the U.S., or an insurrection, or the execution of a constitutional law. Well, obviously none of those three things have held for a very long time, and so the National Guard has been abused.
A formal declaration of war, which hasn't happened since World War II.
Yeah, they lack a formal declaration of war. So the National Guard, we understand, we think of it as kind of the citizen soldier who is at home protecting his home. That's at least the, you know, what people are told when they sign up. So there's been a tremendous abuse of the National Guard. So this is a movement, again, that enjoys wide cross-ideological support. I mean, WorldNet Daily, the conservative/neoconservative website, is in favor of Bring the Guard Home. Liberals, military families, libertarians. So again, this is an area that has great promise if only people would have the guts to pursue it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and one other issue that I don't want to belabor, but the medical marijuana effort, there are a number of states, of course, that have tried to allow for medical marijuana, even though the feds have actually been quite onerous in their opposition to it, and even though the Supreme Court has backed up the federal ban, and yet there are perhaps 1,000 medical marijuana dispensaries in LA County alone. It sounds to me like civil disobedience at the citizen level and nullification on the state level have a lot in common.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, the reason that the Justice Department finally backed down on that was not that it suddenly began doubting its interpretation of the Commerce Clause. It's because the people just weren't going to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the Tenth Amendment Center and their efforts. You mentioned them in your book.
I am a huge fan of the Tenth Amendment Center. TenthAmendmentCenter.com, spelling out the word tenth. They have a wonderful website, blog. They have a wonderful map of the U.S. where it shows all the nullification initiatives and where they're going and how they're doing and what states. And fantastic. And they are launching a nationwide tour of big cities starting in September called Nullify Now. So you can check out nullifynow.com. The idea is just we're going to force this idea into the national conversation by just bringing it everywhere and having huge events and rallies all over the country. So these people are just fantastic. I can't recommend them highly enough.
Well, that's great. So I want to have you start talking about some of these code words that people tend to use to shut down the argument. And by the way, folks, I want to mention that they confuse not only this issue, but a lot of issues. And you make this point quite eloquently with Dr. Bob Murphy in something you'll find on YouTube, I believe, as well as on our blog at RadioFreeMarket.com called An Interview with a Zombie. And it's quite a hilarious but poignant interview. And one of the key aspects of it, I found, Tom, was that you and Bob so eloquently point out this how code words tend to shut down an argument.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'll be glad to. Are we coming up on the break?
Yeah, we're going to be coming up on a break, but just very briefly address this one called neo-Confederate.
Yeah, that's a word that the left and neoconservatives and the mainstream media use to try to demonize anything that involves political decentralization, because they know the word Confederate sounds like slavery to people, and so they just use the word neo-Confederate. But it's such a ridiculous word. California is considering decriminalizing all marijuana. That is a form of state nullification. What that has to do with the Southern Confederacy, I haven't got the foggiest idea. So at some point, they're going to have to address the merits of the case instead of just throwing out these words.
Great. Well, we are coming into our next break and our final break, folks, so please stay with us, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Thomas Woods. And when we come back, we'll be finishing up our conversation on nullification, how it makes us stronger. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Thomas Woods. And, Tom, we were just talking about the code words that tend to try to stop the conversation. And there are these two words that are the most toxic of the code words on this topic of nullification, slavery and racism. Would you respond to those, please?
Sure. First of all, I strongly urge people to watch this interview with a zombie because it answers a lot of this. So I urge people as strongly as I possibly can to go to statenullification.com, where there are a lot of resources on this, but also my video interview with a zombie, because that is exactly what the zombie interviewer is throwing out of these words. Slavery, nullification was never used on behalf of slavery. It was, in fact, used against slavery. It was used by northern states that objected to the fugitive slave laws that required them to return runaway slaves, and they believed that there were unconstitutional aspects of these laws, that they did not like the idea that somebody could come into their state, point to some guy, and say, hey, that looks like the guy I'm looking for, and then just run away. They said, no, nobody's going to leave our state without a jury trial. None of our state officials are going to cooperate in this. So this is the opposite of slavery and the opposite of racism. The whole point of it was to help blacks.
Right. And so the nullification was always used on behalf of blacks and against the enforcement of slavery.
Right. Now it is true that nullification could be used for bad purposes. That's true. But
sure.
but not today, I think, because today everybody has the right to vote. School segregation was occurring at a time when blacks, by and large, didn't have the right to vote. And so you had court cases saying, hey, you better desegregate the schools. Nothing happened. It didn't actually happen until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But now that we've got the right to vote for everybody, it's clear where the threats to our liberties are coming from, and it's not from Santa Fe or Charlotte. It's Washington, D.C. And in particular, we should remember that the greatest foe of states' rights of the whole 20th century was Adolf Hitler, who said repeatedly that he wanted to abolish the powers of the states, he wanted to have the right to impose the Nazi platform on the whole country, regardless of state boundaries. Well, that's the opposite of what we believe.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what are some of the objections to nullification?
Well, the key one that you hear an awful lot is, doesn't this violate the Supremacy Clause of Article 6, which says that the Constitution and laws in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. But notice that it says in laws in pursuance thereof. In other words, the Constitution and constitutional laws shall be the supreme law of the land. It does not say the Constitution and unconstitutional laws shall be the supreme law of the land. So that's what nullifiers are questioning. Is this law pursuant of the Constitution? Is it, in fact, a constitutional law? That's the question. So you can't just say, oh, no, this, it's got to be imposed on everybody, only if it's constitutional.
So tell us again, in summary, how nullification makes us stronger.
Well, I think the main way that it does is that it helps to keep the federal government at bay. It keeps it locked up. And when the predatory sector, I don't call it the public sector, I call it the predatory sector, when it's locked up, then the private sector, the voluntary sector, the competitive sector, the human sector can flourish more more beautifully and unimpeded by the predators in Washington.
Mm-hmm. So I love this quote that you included from Lord Acton, who would be free must themselves strike the blow.
Lord Byron. It's a beautiful statement.
Lord Byron,
I'm sorry. It reminds us that we can't just sit back and hope that somebody's going to put things right for us. We are the somebody, and the instrument we can use are the states that we have allowed to lie dormant for years, but that we can use once again just the way our forebears did.
So I'm going to end the show with a quote from your book that you quote the Connecticut legislature when they voted to nullify the 1807 Embargo Act against the trade with Britain and France, which crippled their economies, resolved that to preserve the Union and support the Constitution of the United States, it becomes the duty of the legislatures of the states in such a crisis of affairs to vigilantly watch over and vigorously maintain the powers not delegated to the United States but reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So thank you, Tom, for being with us today.
Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you.
I greatly appreciate it. And so, folks, visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, and please, wherever you are, stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.